The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
That was Winston Churchill in 1940, just after he had become Prime Minister at one of the most crucial moments in the Second World War. He was twice Prime Minister, 1940 to 45, and again from 51 to 55. But his greatest period is generally agreed to have been his first. If he had not been Prime Minister in 1940, Britain might not have survived the Second World War. Yet power came to Churchill very late in life. He was 65, an age when most people are about to retire. And even so, but for the war, he might never have climbed to the top. So we are concerned here to discover not how Churchill reached the top eventually, but why he did not reach it much earlier. What was it that kept down the greatest Englishman of the 20th century, while persons of far inferior calibre governed the country? Was it due to the envious jealousy of mediocrities who distrusted genius? Or was it due to defects in his own personality, style, and approach? Or was it a mixture of the two? To consider what sort of a person he was, we must go back to the beginning. He was born in 1874, the eldest son of Lord Randolph Churchill, a brilliant but failed politician. He adored his father, but his father regarded him as a fool, apparently with some justification. Sir Harry Verney, later a Liberal MP and a member of Asquith's government, was at Harrow just after Churchill.
He was a little senior to me. And when I got to Harrow, I found there was a well-known tradition of a very stupid little boy who would not learn Latin. Nothing would induce him to it. Of course, we had to start by declining Mensa. And when we had Mensa at table, and then vocative O Mensa, O table, Winston went off the deep end. I'm not going to learn rubbish like this. He wouldn't learn anymore. I don't think he ever learnt the accusative, Mensa. Never got as far as that. And he wouldn't learn. And he didn't learn. He was immensely stupid and known as the most stupid little boy but one in the whole of Harrow. The other stupidest boy of all was the brother Jack. And there were two immensely stupid little boys. And even Weldon couldn't sack two sons of an ex-Chancellor of the Exchequer. And so they stayed on and never learned anything at all. Well, then, just at the end of his time at Harrow, suddenly he fell upon English. And Somerville, Townsend Warner, Howson and Bowen taught him the marvels of English. That's what he got out of Harrow at the very end. And that's the end of them, as far as I'm concerned. There are plenty of stupid little boys. No one as stupid as the two Churchills.
Lord Randolph Churchill died before his son was 21 and seems to have regarded him with contempt. Lady Randolph was extravagant and selfish. Winston had an unhappy, unloved childhood. But whether or not this was the reason, he was from the start intensely ambitious. Mrs. Lucy Masterman, widow of C.F.G. Masterman, who was Under Secretary for Home Affairs when Churchill was Home Secretary, considers that it was not simply ambition.
I should put it the opposite way. I think he was terribly afraid of failing. He'd seen his father go down. He'd read of his father going down like a spent rocket. And he was terribly afraid that he might do the same, I think. I think he had that sort of fear very strongly. Well, as he said into my husband. I shan't live long, which was a pure delusion. And feeling if he was to get ahead at all, he must get ahead soon.
Churchill was restless, active, and determined to make a name. His chosen career, to begin with, was the army, and he contrived to see more campaigning than most cavalry subalterns managed to experience during those relatively peaceful days, in Cuba, the northwest frontier of India, and in the Sudan. At the same time, he supplemented his income by doing the work of a war correspondent. He had no resources of his own. He was anxious to be financially independent before entering politics, which was always his ultimate purpose. And he made a lot of money. It was as a special war correspondent that he served in the South African War and was taken prisoner in November 1899, escaping a month later. That episode certainly hit the headlines in a big way. In the general election of 1900, he got in as Conservative MP for Oldham, and he soon began to attract the attention of the House. But he did not attract the favour of his leaders. He gained no promotion from Arthur Balfour, the new Prime Minister. In 1904, he crossed the floor of the House and became a Liberal. His public reason was support of free trade against tariffs. Perhaps it was not his only reason. Mrs. Masterman again.
I do think it was because I think Balfour treated him badly. I mean, he was far abler than a good many of that front bench. And he was exactly, I should have thought, the young sort of young man who ought to have been hauled in and given the grooming of an under-secretaryship to teach him the job. But Balfour didn't like him for some reason, and I think Sanders aggravated the dislike.
Sanders was Balfour's private secretary and eminence grise, and he perhaps shared Balfour's dislike for Churchill. Certainly Churchill, in an unguarded moment, when asked by Mrs. Joseph Chamberlain why he had crossed the floor, said, "I know Arthur Balfour will do nothing for me." Whatever his reasons, Churchill's change of party was opportune. From 1905, for the next 17 years, governments were to be in power which were either wholly or partly liberal. Churchill's first office was colonial under-secretary to the Secretary of State, Lord Elgin. Sir Harry Verney, Lord Elgin's parliamentary private secretary, saw Churchill in action at close range.
Well, then, there is Winston as an under-secretary, and he couldn't do anything without the approval of the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State was completely dominant. The Secretary of State said no, it was no, and nothing Winston could do could change it. The troublesome part was when he began to take notice of places in which he knew nothing. As under-secretary, everything went through him, and Winston wrote long minutes in red ink, and they'd go up to the Secretary of State, E. That's all. E. For Elgin. And that was the end of that file. You couldn't do anything more. You couldn't appeal at liberty to appeal to. You couldn't go beyond that. If I may be indiscreet, there's one very curious thing that happened. Winston and a governor quarrelled. But a very distinguished governor. And Winston wrote to Lord Elgin to say, this man must go. We must get him to resign. A long, long minute in red ink, a page or more. No, E. And over again, he found his brilliant suggestions, E. Not even no, the particular one of the governor, no, but the other, E, E, E. And we used to look for these to come out, long, long minute to Winston, E. And you couldn't appeal, that's what I think Winston never realized. But as a matter of fact, of course, Lord Elgin was right. And Winston couldn't suddenly think he knew everything and quarrel with governors of whom he knew very little. And he had to be set on. But then the next thing Lord Elgin said to me, I was one of his private secretaries, we must prevent this man coming dashing into my room without any warning. I'm busy talking to a governor or busy doing some very important things. In comes Winston. I can't have it. You mustn't let him come in. So it was given to me to thwart him. And the way I thwarted him was to collect all the people who were faithful and bring them along the door there so Winston couldn't get in. And so we did more or less squash Winston. And when he wanted to go into Lord Elgin, he found the doors blocked He had to go round by us and get in when he could, in his turn.
This enthusiasm and energy with which Churchill hurled himself into every job may have been irritating, but it was an element in his rise to power. In 1908, he entered the cabinet as president of the Board of Trade, and, together with Lloyd George as Chancellor of the Exchequer, played an important part in the foundations of what we now call the welfare state. 2 years later, Churchill was made Home Secretary. Lucy Masterman.
He was a Home Secretary prepared to do things. Winston wanted to do things. The head civil servant of the Home Office said, "He drives me crazy sometimes, but he's the first great Home Secretary we've had since Asquith."
Mrs. Masterman also points out Churchill's considerable humanity in this most difficult of posts.
He was an innovating Home Secretary to begin with, and he was a very compassionate person, you know. I mean, a thing I didn't hear of, actually, because it was a matter of detail till later, there are a lot of old convicts who've been back again and again and again. They were never going to go straight and they'd never get a job. Well, he arranged that at Parkhurst there was a special sitting room for them with armchairs. Another thing was, he don't say he ever contemplated getting rid of the capital punishment, but he couldn't sleep tonight before an execution.
In 1911, Churchill became First Lord of the Admiralty. He was, on any view, a brilliant and far-sighted minister. He was responsible for many important naval reforms. But he continued to be obsessive about his own office, a point Lucy Masterman underlines.
When he got to the Admiralty, he became really rather a terror to his colleagues because he was always talking about the Navy and that sort of thing. And Lloyd George complained that he got him in a corner and kept on talking about his blasted ships, which Lloyd George was not particularly interested in.
Thus we have a picture of him before 1914 as a vigorous, energetic, no doubt troublesome and argumentative, young, middle-aged man, clearly on his way up. He had made all the right moves, perhaps unconsciously rather than by deliberate design, but highly successfully. On the face of things, war, for which so much of his career had prepared him, ought to have consolidated his position. In fact, it did just the opposite. His grand design for victory was the Dardanelles expedition, an attempt to break through to Constantinople, knock out the Turks, and secure a supply route to Russia. But he had no real support from the cabinet. Lord Boothby, who later, as a young Conservative MP, was one of Churchill's few devoted friends in the interwar years, comments on Churchill's role over the Dardanelles.
"I think the Dardanelles, which has been hailed in the past as the great strategic conception of the First World War, and there's truth in that, was very badly bungled, and I think that the fault primarily was Churchill's, because he tried to undertake a hazardous major operation of war from what he himself has described as a subordinate position, and to run the whole thing. In fact, he did say, in summing the whole thing up, men are ill-advised to attempt such ventures from his position."
There can be endless controversy about the merits of the Dardanelles campaign. There can be little doubt that its failure greatly damaged Churchill's reputation. When Asquith felt obliged to form a coalition government with the Conservatives in May 1915, Churchill's removal from the Admiralty was made an absolute condition by Bonar Law, the Conservative leader. Churchill was shunted into a minor office, resigned at the end of the year, and rejoined the army. He soon returned to politics. But when the great political crisis of December 1916 occurred, and Asquith was ousted, and Lloyd George, Churchill's friend, became Prime Minister, Churchill, much to his mortification, was not included in the new government. 6 months later, he was made Minister of Munitions, but this had ceased by then to be a key office. However, after the end of the war, in Lloyd George's new coalition from 1918 to 22, Churchill was first Minister for War and Air, and then for the colonies. His stock seemed to be rising. Yet in spite of this, he did many things which inspired doubts. And he began to acquire a reputation, very unfair no doubt, but nonetheless damaging, for being a warmonger. Sir Oswald Mosley, who after service in the war entered Parliament in 1918, describes his own doubts about Churchill.
I believe him to be personally an entirely honest, genuine, and magnanimous character, but he had a certain emotional and impulsive instability. My mistrust of him arose from his inveterate drive towards war, coming out of the First War after experience in the fighting of the air and trenches and the loss of all my companions. My obsession, if you like, was to avoid another war. And Churchill, immediately after that war, in Mesopotamia, now called Iraq, in his Russian adventure, his attempt, ineffective attempt to crush Bolshevism in its early days, in Chenak, which was as much or more the fault of Lloyd George, seemed to me continually driving towards war.
Churchill, however, possessed a charm which even his critics found it hard to resist. Sir Oswald Mosley remembers one of his own parliamentary exchanges with Churchill.
I remember on one occasion when a debate fell very flat and I was speaking for the Labour Party and got up at the end of the debate and made a rather flashy, noisy speech. Churchill had to wind up for the government. And he began rather laboriously in his fashion how disastrous was the day for the Labour Party, all was lost and the rest of it. And then he said, and at the end of the, on this stricken field, forth springs our young Astyanax, the hope of Troy, you see. And everybody roared with laughter, and the joke was entirely turned on me. And I was very puzzled, because I thought he's never read a line of Homer in his life. How on earth did he pull this one on me? So I was walking through the lobby afterwards, and up he came, rolling along and grinning in his way, dug me in the ribs, and said, my boy, Bartlett's popular quotations, never be without them. And you know, that was part of his charm, which endeared him to the younger generation. There was absolutely no humbug about him. He hated what he called the goody-goodies and all the rest of it.
This charm did not prevent Churchill acquiring an aura of mistrust which remained with him for many years. It was not diminished by his second change of party. In 1922, he lost office with the fall of the Lloyd George coalition, and he lost his seat at the ensuing general election. He decided, rightly, that the Liberals had no future. After various vicissitudes, including standing for Parliament under the tongue-twisting title of an anti-socialist constitutionalist, he was offered the post of Chancellor by Baldwin in 1924. He accepted with alacrity. And, so the story goes, under the impression that he was being made Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, not, as Baldwin meant, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Lord Boothby, who was Churchill's parliamentary private secretary at the time, is critical of Churchill's period in office.
Oh, very bad Chancellor of the Exchequer. His whole objective was to reduce the income tax by a shilling, which was quite unnecessary, because everybody was very well off, or rather the rich were very well off then, and there was no need for it. And he didn't really understand monetary policy or finance policy. He once said to me, if only these treasury fellows and the city bankers who come and see me were admirals or generals, I could talk to them in their own language and make them do what I wanted. But after a time, they start talking Persian, and then I'm sunk.
A similar view is held by Sir Oswald Mosley, who feels that Churchill was very much under the sway of the treasury officials.
Churchill came to the problem of that kind, the return to the gold standard and the rest of it, knowing little, the prisoner of the party, and unable to go against the orthodox opinion. I think it's fair to say that he knew little, in light of his famous observation, that unemployment had no more to do with the gold standard than the Gulf Stream, which is only equaled by his father's exclamation at the Treasury as Chancellor of the Exchequer, when confronted for the first time with the mysteries of the decimal system, in asking, what are those damn dots? And the strong point of the Churchill family was never economics.
It does not follow that such criticisms of Churchill as Chancellor are fully justified. A case can be made in his defence, and he was certainly responsible for many improvements in social services. But the point is that these adverse opinions were very widely held. Lord Boothby makes a further point about Churchill's determination to reduce income tax.
This passion to get the income tax down led to the ludicrous 10-year rule that he laid down as Chancellor, that there would be no war and no war was to be contemplated for 10 years, and this was to be advanced progressively from year to year. And that, then he scaled down on our naval and military forces and the Air Force to practically nil. And that was the... It's forgotten now, but the truth is that it was the basis of our weakness in the 1930s. Churchill disarmed the country between 1925 and 1930 as nobody's ever disarmed this country before.
Another point that counted against Churchill at this time was his behaviour during the general strike of 1926. Here is Lord Citrine, who was General Secretary of the TUC at that time.
We scarcely ever saw Churchill face to face during the strike, and we could only judge his conduct by what we saw in the British Gazette, the paper which he controlled on behalf of the government. And it was vicious to an extreme. I was told later, only a few years ago, by Lord Davidson, who really edited that paper, that some of the things that Churchill wanted him to put in the paper and insisted upon him putting in the paper made his blood boil. And he refused to do it. On occasions he got in touch with the government to take Baldwin and the government's decision as to whether such things should be said.
Some years later, Lord Citrine sat next to Churchill at dinner and talked to him about the general strike.
I said to him, you didn't believe all that rubbish you put in the British Gazette about our trying to break the Constitution. Oh, yes, he said, I did. He said, I was in the country when the strike started, he said, and I saw red. I thought this must be revolution. And I came back to London, he said, determined to fight it.
The Conservatives were defeated in the election of 1929. Churchill, in opposition, parted company with Baldwin on the question whether to support the Labour Party and the Conservative Viceroy of India, Lord Halifax, in their policy of dominion status and self-government for India. Churchill resigned from the Shadow Cabinet on the Indian question, and when the overwhelmingly Conservative coalition of 1931 was formed under Ramsay MacDonald, he was not invited to join. No doubt the leaders were glad to have the excuse. But it would be difficult to deny that Churchill had brought it on himself, at least to a very considerable extent. And he made his position worse by persisting in his intemperate opposition to the India Bill long after it was futile to do so, and then by his attitude in supporting King Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, during the abdication crisis. Lord Boothby again.
He didn't understand the reaction of the ordinary man in the street. He had no real sympathy with his aspirations, with his prejudices, with his hopes, and with his fears. Churchill was an extraordinary man, and he had no knowledge of the ordinary man at all. That, you see, accounts for his frightful misjudgment over the abdication. I mean, he just misjudged the whole temper and feeling of the people over the abdication. And it was another example of a blunder, of a colossal error of judgment. And that finished him. The abdication crisis finished him in this country politically. And that's why, after that, when he became increasingly aware of the growing menace of Hitler and demanded rearmament on the greatest scale in this country, and especially in the air, and all his warnings were completely justified by events, they were disregarded because he himself was disregarded. But he brought it on himself by the tremendous errors of judgment that he'd made on big issues, where he completely misjudged the feelings of the man in the street.
The result was that Churchill was not listened to, even when he was in the right. Lord Boothby sums up parliamentary opinion about him.
I would say that from 1937 to 1939, his influence in the House of Commons was about zero, and his friends amounted to about four, of whom I was one. You see, people remembered a lot of things, and he was associated with a whole series of failures, which people put down to lack of judgment. And therefore I would say they didn't distrust him personally, but they distrusted his judgment.
The truth was that Churchill seemed, both to the man in the street and to the average MP of all parties, an erratic, dangerous figure. Too ambitious, too pushing, too much on the personal make. This impression may well have been unfair, but it was at least in part Churchill's own fault that it existed. In addition, he was associated in people's minds with certain major blunders or errors of judgment. In a parliamentary democracy, it is essential to inspire trust and confidence. Churchill did not, anyway in peacetime, when nothing very much seemed to be happening. It is perhaps in this contrast between the wartime and the peacetime Prime Minister that the key to Churchill's career can be found. It is true that even in the First World War, he had been associated with a major failure, the Dardanelles. But as time went on, it somehow became muffled, mainly through Churchill's own eloquent defence of his conduct. And when war broke out in 1939, he was shown to have been right on one supreme issue, if on no others, the danger of Hitler and German rearmament. It is not surprising that most people reversed their opinion of him almost overnight. Sir Oswald Mosley.
The English people supported him, and they were right in this sense that if they wanted a war and had a war or thought it necessary, he was obviously the man for it, the only man who over years had trained himself for that purpose, the only man with the character and with the dynamism to see it through among the people who thought that a war was necessary. And therefore, he was a man of emergency and not a man of normal times, and the British people in broad judgment were right not to employ him in the first position normally, but to employ him only abnormally, which a war was.
Churchill himself agreed that had it not been for the Second World War, ironically the one enormous stroke of luck or chance in his career that operated in his favour, he would never have reached the top. Lord Boothby.
Luck played a terrific part. And he said to me, in 1940, it took Armageddon to make me Prime Minister. And it did. And whether you can call the Second World War luck, I should doubt. But at any rate for Churchill, there's no question that the outbreak of the Second World War brought him to supreme power, and that if that war hadn't happened, he never would have attained supreme power.
We have seen what went wrong with him in peacetime. But we should not forget that he did get to the top, and that he was one of the greatest statesmen in our history. What was his great virtue? What was the justification of the confidence ultimately reposed in him? Lord Boothby.
Oh, undoubtedly, without any question at all, courage. He had absolute moral and absolute physical courage. And that flared up for all the world to see in 1940. Because there he really was up against it. I mean, the world thought we were beaten, and his courage was imparted to the British people in the most extraordinary way, and I think it saved us. And I never knew any occasion in his life when he wasn't absolutely dauntless, especially in the face of adversity. I think that's his supreme quality, was courage. Imagination up to a point, but imagination very often led him to wrong judgments and wrong conclusions. But the courage was always there. I should say it certainly was his supreme quality.